Ecclesiastes had an introductory class on the life of Solomon, this most fascinating and astonishing and amazing, accomplished individual who has experienced all that this world can offer, and to a degree that is just unparalleled, really, in human history. Fascinating character, who then many have suggested, and it may well be the case, though he doesn't state so directly, toward the end of his life, and as a consequence of his experiences and his wisdom, writes this book of Ecclesiastes. And I really do not know if it, you know, when in his life it was written, but he is a man who has, as we'll see, especially tonight in the second chapter, done so many things, and things which, some of which required years and years to accomplish, that it's expected that he is at least in the middle to later parts of his life. He brings then the insight, the observations that he alone really was prepared by God and by his life's experiences to teach us. Last week we got into the book itself, we went through chapter 1, and I pointed out there that his modus operandi, I guess you would say, is to contemplate with a very narrow focus the effects of life on the earth if you just sort of set God aside for the moment. Now, God is really not very far from his equations here, not very far from his mind at all. God's name will be invoked. We're going to be hearing about him as we go through the book. But the purpose of the book is to focus then on life under the sun, the expression he uses so much. And so, when we read, as again I pointed out last week, for those some of you who may not have been here last week, when we read in the second verse, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity," we do need to be careful not to make a mistake that I think is often made, that this is the writing of a hopeless man, that this is the writing of a depressed and discouraged individual. This is the writing of someone, you know, who is just so despondent that all he can do is just pour out this agony. That is not the case. The man is very consciously and very wisely saying, I just want to, for a moment, contemplate the physicality, the materialism of this universe, and if one gives themselves to that, no matter to what degree they give themselves to that, no matter how successful they are in the things of the flesh, they are not going to find that it is ultimately or permanently satisfying. It's just not. There is ultimately no enduring or significant or substantial profit in those things in and of themselves. But for a few exceptions. Tonight, I do want to ask everybody, you know, get your pencils ready and your colored markers and whatever else, you know, note-taking equipment. Tonight, excuse me, I'm going to go through this second chapter to about the one-third mark, I guess it is, and then we will come to the first place where there's really a very positive statement that is made. In quite a few occasions, Solomon is going to speak of reward in this life. And so it's already a mistake to think that he's totally despondent. It would be a further mistake to think that he sees absolutely no good in life. If that were the case, then again, I suppose you probably would be despondent. And so it's this very narrow focus about the end result and the permanence of things that is vanity. And yet he is going to guide us through this earth so that he will teach us what is of ultimate importance. Last verses of the 12th chapter, which we started with last week. But he's also going to show how it is that you can be very happy, very satisfied, and live a most enjoyable life despite the fact that the second verse is still true. Okay. It's so recognizing that there is futility, that there is vanity, that there is emptiness in life, he's going to grapple with that emptiness and teach us how to be just preeminently satisfied with life while you're here, but also carefully living that life so that you can have an eternal reward that life in the future. So tonight, I struggled with this. I think rather than just pointing them out each time as we go along throughout these chapters, we'll read down to the first one, and I'll have you mark it, and then we'll take a few minutes and we'll go look at every one, and I'll just have you circle those verses. You know, you'll get the whole gist there. What I've done in my Bible is to use a green marker for just the verse numbers, so that I can turn each page, and very quickly I can see every passage where he points out that there is some joy or some reward or some satisfaction, some blessing that there is to be found in this world of vanity. So let's start with chapter 2 now, and verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. And behold, it too was futility. So the topic that is immediately at hand in that single verse, and then it's going to be developed in various different areas, is pleasure, the satisfaction of the flesh, the gratification of both the mind and the body here under the sun. So I'm going to test myself with pleasure. And so he gives himself, if you will, in verse 1, permission. Enjoy yourself. It was futility. And so in verse 2 he says, I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Now let's take the laughter thing first. Raise your hand if you like to laugh. I like to laugh. I once read the actual medical report suggesting that if you want to live long and or if you're suffering some malady and you're sick or you've got a surgery, an injury or whatever it is, that you really ought to pull the comedy videos off your shelf and watch those. That they will help you to heal. They will help you to feel better. That they help you to endure pain. Laughter is enjoyable. We prefer it over many other emotions that might be named. Laughter is a thing that is appealing. However, when you're laughing, do you have complete control over yourself? Now, I just love it when Donna goes on vacation, as long as you don't tell her. Okay? Periodically, it doesn't happen very often, my wife will experience something that I think you all experience. And every so often, and the rest of us will be sitting in the room and it won't seem to make any sense. You know, some word will be spoken, something happens, she sees something on the TV, and she will lose it. She starts laughing. It is a paroxysm of joy. It is a fit. It is so delightful. What does it make me do? Same thing. And then for a little while, both of us are just completely out of control. I'm telling you, somebody gets ready to say, your house is on fire, we would giggle all the way out to the freeway. you lose it. Laughter is a response to a stimulus. And that stimulus, for one reason or another, amuses the mind. It tickles it. And when it does, apparently, just all sorts of electrical activity takes place in your brain just ignites it. And the next thing you know, you're shaking and you're laughing. You may actually go down to the floor. You know, how do you say the funniest thing you think you've ever seen? But in my mind, I think the funniest thing I've ever seen was my younger son coming into the kitchen at about the age of a young teen. I don't know, maybe 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there. He had inline skates on. And so he had come off the carpet. He was now on the vinyl. And as he turned the corner to come into the U-shaped kitchen, I had my back at the bottom of the U. And he came around the corner. And I understand he's not racing through the house. He just had him. He came in. And so, you know, he was trying to walk. And suddenly, both feet went out in front of him. And here I was standing looking at him. And as both feet just came up in a V, the look on his face of such helpless surprise is the funniest thing I think I have ever seen. And then, poof, his rope hit the bottom, and we just laughed at his thing because it was so unexpected. unexpected, and so uncontrollable. That may be the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. But at that moment, I was out of control. I could not discipline myself. I could not say to myself, do this or do that. And it went on and on and on and on. What is it? Solomon's word, what is it? It's madness. Is what it is. Laughter is madness. Now, it's a form of madness that we enjoy. But the wisest man who ever lived looked at it very carefully, having entertained himself with every imaginable pleasure known to man. And when he was all done analyzing it with the biggest intellect, God's divine bestowal of wisdom, and all the physical stimulation that the world could offer, he analyzed that thing, and when he got to through poking it in his petri dish, what did he say it is? It's madness. Is he right? Of course he's right. Okay? Now, the second part of the verse, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Now, I can't tell for sure if these two should be linked together in that verse or if they're intended to be very separate. But nonetheless, let's put them together here in the first. What does laughter accomplish, and what does pleasure accomplish? When you're all done laughing, what have you accomplished? You're the innocent victim. It happened to you. Something else external stimulated it. You reacted, and when it was over, well, I was temporarily insane. That's what it was. And pleasure. What does it accomplish when you gratify your flesh? Think of the best meal you ever ate. Two, for me, immediately come to mind. And they just stick. I got out of the Army in 1973, in September of 1973. I immediately crossed the country to Colorado to start a two-year Bible school that I had enrolled in, taking my first formal Bible class lessons. When I rolled into town in Colorado, I was hungry. I went to a big Dutch windmill that they had as a restaurant. And I say, I'll never forget it. It was either lobster Thermidor or lobster Newburgh. I can't remember which one it was that I ordered. Back when they still had lobster and you could afford it. So I had either a Newburgh or a Thermidor, and I don't know the difference between the two. But I remember just being astonished while I sat there and savored that meal. The second time was when I went to the Philippines, and I don't know if Jerry experienced this or not, but I went to the Philippines to Mindanao, and in General Santos City, you have one of the great fishing capitals of the world. And they have a huge open-air market there, though it is shed roofs. You know, it's open air. And I mean, there will be hundreds of fish that you've never heard of and you've never seen before. Okay? And these people understand fish as much as their economy depends on it. And so, we were a week in General Santos City. I taught the Book of Proverbs while I was there. And we had meals of fish that were, as we say, to die for. How many of you have seen What About Bob? Remember the salad? That's what I was like. Oh, this is so wonderful. Okay? And then I ate the last bite, slid down my throat, and what did it accomplish?
5 pounds.
5 pounds. Okay? What it accomplished was the stimulation of my taste buds in a very temporary satisfaction to hunger. And then what? It became a memory. And if you ask me, what did that fish look like? What did that fish taste like? I am helpless to tell you. Sabre?
It accomplishes sustaining your longing.
He can't be alive.
That's right.
Everybody does it. He's still alive. That's true. This is life under the sun. Okay. But did it leave anything behind other than that life? Did I build anything? What did it do? It was the antidote to what? Death. Okay? A particularly tasty antidote to death. But that's what it was. It was forestalling something else. Okay? I said of laughter, it's madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? Now, remember verse 8 from chapter 1, second half. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. And ever since 1973 and 1996, what have I been wanting to do? Get those meals back. The first one I've never been able to afford again. And I never went back to the Philippines. Okay? Haven't accomplished a thing. So, verse 3 now becomes an elaboration. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. Now, you might want to highlight verse 3 because it is a declaration of his purpose in the book. Though he doesn't really identify it as such, throughout the book he's going to keep coming back to this theme. What good is there for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of your lives? What good is there in it is the great quest of the book of Ecclesiastes. He will not come home from that hunt empty-handed. We'll give you a whole bunch of those rewards in a minute. But now he just wants to test everything. So pleasure is the overarching category. Laughter is the direct result of pleasure. And then he mentions the pleasure again in verse 2. Now we have wine that he's going to study. In verse 4, I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself, from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had home-born slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men, many concubines. And one last verse. Then I became great and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. Now, here is a scientist. Here is an expert in all things. You remember, he wrote whole books and treatises, you know, on zoology and botany and all the rest of it that either I referenced or you're familiar with from the opening class. This man, and here again I'd suggest you get out your pencil and just circle the areas in which he tested himself. Circle the word in verse 2, laughter, and the word pleasure. In verse 3, circle the word wine, or note it somehow. Verse 4, houses and vineyards. Verse 5, there's three of them, gardens, parks, and trees. Verse 6, ponds and a forest. And then, in verse 7, slaves. In verse 7, also, flocks and herds. In verse 8, you've got five of them. Silver, gold, treasure, singers, and concubines.
The last thing you just said,
that seems like an impossibly different thing. What translation was that again?
The concubines is the footnote. Musical instruments is the main text.
But what's the translation?
American Standard.
Okay.
Is
that right?
And the Old King James.
Well, I wish you guys wouldn't do this to me because it only reveals my ignorance. I've never heard that. It is completely stunning to me. And so, you know, I don't know how to address it. So I just have to go to work on it. Is there any additional information on the footnotes?
The thing that I see is where it says men singers and women singers. And then it says, and the light of the sons of men.
Okay.
So that would be the concubines to me. That, you know,
okay.
But then it says, as musical instruments, and that of all sorts.
All right. You know, all I can say to that is obviously there is a textual variation somewhere
in which manuscripts have one and which manuscripts have the other. You know, I couldn't begin to tell you, so I have to do a little bit of research on that one. But they're not interchangeable by any means. It has to be a textual, you know, question. Either way, the man is investigating pleasure. By the way, how many wives did he have? He had 700. What's the verse? Okay, you know, at verse 8, I would write in the margin 1 Kings 11, verse 3, which tells you that he had 700 wives. How many concubines did he have? 300. 700 and 300.
Okay, that's a lot of women.
Some people have said, again, impossibly many, and try to argue that they're just round numbers and say fullness. I don't think so myself. But
when you're talking about that word in verse 7, it says, I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. And in the days of the slaves, if a child was born with your concubine, it bore your name, and so maybe that's what that means.
There's an excellent observation, and again, I just have to do some research on that. But it is true, everything that Jimmy's just said, and wanted to touch on it. Now, brethren, in many cultures, and I'm not sure I've done enough study on it to tell you, but perhaps even in most cultures in world history, polygamy was very acceptable. It wasn't any, you know, stigma attached to it. And that is also true of the Jews in the sight of God and under the oversight of God. What Solomon is doing right there, you know, is not forbidden by God. Now, on the 700 and the 300, the wives had a higher status than a concubine. But a concubine was not someone that was looked down upon in any culture. She is not a prostitute. She has legal protections and rights, status in that community. And her children, as Jimmy just said, are the legitimate sons of the father. And so it is not a marriage. It is a concubinage. If you haven't done any reading on it, just go to Wikipedia, and it'll be fascinating. They'll give you a number of different cultures. You know, it's a good place to start. There'll be hosts of other websites that you can look at. You get all kinds of data today on it. But a concubine was not a woman who was looked down upon in any society where they were doing that. However, she did not have the same degree of status or authority and did not have a say in what we'll call the family government. Okay? She would find out what the wives had decided to do, even though her children were sons. You know, still, the wives, they made the choices. Okay? And then lastly, understand that as unusual as it is, you can have a marriage without a sexual relationship. And many people have and or do for a wide variety of reasons. So when people say Solomon didn't have that many wives and should just be understood figuratively or something like that, they typically are only arguing it is impossible for any one man to be sexually active with that many women.
Geraldo Rivera and several basketball players, you know, to the contrary. But nonetheless, you know, it's a silly argument because being involved with the woman sexually hasn't got anything to do with whether or not you're married. All of the legal status and responsibilities and opportunities and advantages that come with the marriage exist whether or not that particular activity ever takes place. He could have married 10,000 wives. He could have married 50,000 wives. It would have then only become a matter only of the limitation of time it takes to recite the vows. Okay? So it just frustrates me when I see people argue this way because I think first and foremost, you know, they just don't understand what, you know, marriages and concubinage was really all about. But I don't want to take a whole lot of time on this, but just to say that whether or not the word is in all the manuscripts that we have, Solomon had certainly experienced that realm of human activity to its fullest extent as well. And he had plenty of kids to prove it. So, now that you've listed all these things, laughter, pleasure, wine, houses, vineyards, gardens, parks, trees, ponds, forests, slaves, flocks, herds, silver, gold, treasure, singers, well, the singers would have had music, you know, involved as well, and then the concubines, this man is doing what in verse 1? What's the operative word in verse 1 of chapter 2? I will test you with pleasure. So behold, you know, so enjoy yourself. It was a scientific observation. And even in the use of wine, he had set about to analyze what takes place with regard to wine. Now, in so doing, is he going to experience what it is to drink an alcoholic beverage? Yes. Is that the only way you can draw conclusions about the influence of vines? No, what's another way you could come to a scientific understanding of the effect of wine? Watch somebody else. Okay? And so I'm sure he himself was testing himself with pleasure, but bear in mind, this is an extremely broad mind that we're working with here. And his analysis, I think, is going to include the observations of others as well. All of it, at the end of verse 1, is what? Futility. And at the end of verse 2, what does it accomplish? Okay? So, he gave, in verse 3, he explored with his mind how to stimulate his body while his mind was guiding him wisely, and how to take hold of folly, which suggests that he recognized that some of these things were just folly, until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. After he now lists all these things that he has done, and he states in verse 9 that he became great and increased more than all who preceded him in Jerusalem, but his wisdom never deserted him. It stood by him. He gives you the first good about life under the sun in verse 10. So now if you're going to use a different sort of marking system, go to clouds instead of circles or squares, you know, a different color pen, whatever you're going to do, you want to highlight somehow verse 10. All that my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. Now, does it matter anymore if the word concubine or instrumental music is the last word in verse 8? No. He did it all. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. What was the reward? The heart was pleased. What did he not withhold from himself in any form, according to both verse 1 and verse 2? Pleasure. What does the word pleasure come from? Pleased. It was pleasing. Okay? Now, how come I can remember lobster?
3. It pleased me. And it deeply pleased me. I mean, it thoroughly pleased me. It stuck. It pleased me.
You will spend your life collecting such memories. My son falling on his rump also pleased me.
A little bit of humility you learned there. And a bonding that took place at that moment.
And many other things that will please you. And this is your reward for all your labor.
Now, is that a lot of reward? Kind of depends. You know, how you think about it, doesn't it? So he says, at the end of verse 1, it is what? It's futility, but it is pleasure. Why do you think it's futility? Because of chapter 1, verse 8. What did he say in chapter 1, verse 8? So, your eyes, your ears, and it includes every other one of your senses. You get the pleasure. Does it last? No. But you retain the memory. So what then do you want? To do it again and again and again until you get sated with it. And then what? You want to do something else or more thereof so that you can get that feeling back again. But how substantial is pleasure? Dude, it did feel good. You see that? And that is a reward. Is it okay in Solomon's mind for people to experience pleasure with the flesh? Sure it is. Okay? Now, Old Testament or New, by the way, do either Testament suggest that people ought to become monks, nuns? He never does. Discipline and self-control is what Solomon is commending to everyone, and it was the way by which he experienced all these things. But pleasure, for pleasure's sake, certain careful discipline, you know, and limitations, is fine. So, all that his eyes desired, verse 10, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. But as soon as he throws in that word, all my labor, what is he saying? Is there work involved in pleasure? There can be. Just a whole lot of work, as a matter of fact. Okay? And so, today, it'll probably take you about 2 days worth of work to make enough money to buy a lobster thermidor.
Wait, things are going. You need a whole lot of work. Now, verse 11. Thus, I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. It wasn't bankable. It wasn't something you could store and put away. It didn't really give you a big advantage. You just got it, you took pleasure in it, and now you got to repeat the cycle again. And you just become the gerbil on the wheel. And he knew it. Verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? I hate to tell you this, people, but I went down to California, healthy as I could be.
Went up to Washington for 3 days, healthy as I could be. Got about 30 minutes south of Portland, and what did I start doing? Coffee.
Tis the season, I guess, but I got down into the valley of sickness, and sure enough, you know, immediately, I started experiencing what I'm experiencing right now. Okay, so, up to this point, what is the one category that he has been considering to study? Pleasure. Laughter was distinguished from it, but it's a natural result of pleasure. I'll put him in the same category. Now, what three areas does he decide he's going to analyze? Wisdom, madness, and folly. Somebody tell me the difference between those three. Smart enough to know the differences. Okay, Carol?
Well, wisdom is the proper application of knowledge. So that makes your life better. Madness, if you consider what he said, is when you're out of control with laughter and you're not really thinking in your best. And folly is a slippery slope.
Okay. Folly comes from our word for fool. It's probably the other way around now that I think about it. But, you know, a fool is the opposite of what? A wise man. He gives you a spectrum from wisdom to fool. Okay? And in between, there are very smart people who can also be, you know, completely crazy. How many of you have ever actually met someone, had to deal or talk with somebody who was, and I'm not saying this, you know, in any kind of a humorous way, I mean certifiably, they were crazy. Okay, they were out of their minds. Okay, most of us have at some point in our lives, and we don't mean that they did something, you know, that just didn't make any sense. I'm talking about people who, when you're in their presence, you are frightened. Now, in my capacity as a preacher, I've had to deal with that on more than one occasion. And there's been more than one time when I was frightened what is going to happen next. Because this person is irrational. This person is out of their heads. Anything can happen. I had a schizophrenic one time who jumped out of my car while I was driving. I could see that he was about to bail, and so I hit the brakes. And I was able to slow down enough that when he threw the door open and flung himself out into the wind, he was able to roll off the pavement and onto the grass and was relatively uninjured. But when that happens, you are not experiencing wisdom. And you're not experiencing folly either. Smart people do foolish things. What was this? This was madness. The last we ever heard from him, he called in a rainstorm from some state in the East Coast and said that he could only speak for a few minutes because the brain police were scanning for him. And he could hide from them as long as he was not on the phone. So he wanted to issue this transmission to a friend of mine, and then quickly she heard him in a phone booth, rain falling, you know, he explained it, and then he fled the scene. That was the last anybody ever heard of it. Somewhere tonight, out in the eastern state, thinking that the brain police were hunting him down. Okay? Solomon is a king. He sees everybody in his kingdom. And he was in a position, by the way, as the ultimate judge, as you well remember with the famous baby story. He is the arbiter for the whole nation. Who has come before him in the course of his reign? The wisest who ever lived, and the most foolish, and in between, complete insanity. So, let's study that also. In verse 12, what will the man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? I'm going to go ahead and study this, and then whatever I discover, it's just going to, the next guy after me is going to have to do the same thing. Verse 13 is your second reward or positive thing. I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. Well, duh.
No, that's right, but that's because we've given our lives to the pursuit of wisdom, and we've been studying our Bibles all of our lives, and we, you know, have been alert like Solomon to what life is like as we observe in other people, or maybe experienced ourselves, when you are without Christ and without that guidance in the direction of Scripture. But he saw it. And he declares it as the man who has experienced and explored and constantly has analyzed the furthest reaches of four categories: pleasure, wisdom, madness,
and folly. And when he got done with the four, what was the one that was the reward?
Wisdom.
Wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. And that's not hard to understand. Been having trouble out the house with my electrical. E-Web came out 2 days ago, came back again today. Both times we had to turn the power out. As soon as you turn the power out, you experience a whole new world, don't you? I tell you, light excels darkness, you know, even in broad daylight when you get into your room. Verse 14, one of my favorite passages in the book. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness, and yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Now, the wise man's eyes are in his head. Are not the fool's eyes in the same place?
He doesn't mean sockets in the skull, does he? The wise man's eyes are in his head. He's thinking, observing, watching, contemplating, deciding. Where are the fool's eyes?
Just everywhere. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. When I'm in darkness, I'm looking everywhere, trying desperately to identify, recognize, you know, and avoid hurt. Wise man's eyes are in his head. They're where they belong. They're doing what they're supposed to do. Wise man, a fool rather, darkness always. And yet, where are they both headed? Brethren, they're headed for the same place that Jeannie went so unexpectedly on Sunday morning, going about her daily business in preparation to be with you so she could come to the presence of her God and worship Him. And she was just struck down and gone. We know her to have been wise. But the fool dies exactly the same way we die. Then I said to myself in verse 15, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. So matter of fact, wisdom, you know, excels folly as light does darkness. But will it spare you the physical fate of every human being? Never will. Okay, and hold on a second. I got two more verses. 4, verse 16. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool alike die. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. Brethren, the work is grievous. It really is. What's the one reward? Pleasure. Periodically and cyclically. And better to be a wise man than a fool while you're caught, you know, in the circle. But, who's going to remember? Now, we've got the Bible. We've got books that tell us about Solomon. We know somewhat about Solomon. Okay? Is it much about anybody that's ever lived? Is it much? No. About just Jesus, how many books could have been written? Enough to fill the whole world. Okay? Nobody remembers. Now, verse 17, because it all just ends. It's all futility and striving after wind. Now, I've got those 10 minutes, so here we go. Let's mark all the passages where you have a reward. At chapter 2 and verse 10, you have the first one. I'm not even going to read them. I'm just going to give you the verses. So make your mark at chapter 2, verse 10. Then in that chapter at verse 13, and next week we'll take up the last three verses of chapter 2, verses 24, 25, and 26. Then in chapter 3, highlight somehow verses 12 and 13. 12 and 13, and then skip down again, coincidentally, to the last verse in the chapter, verse 22. In chapter 4, highlight verse 6 and verse 13. chapter 4, 6 and 13. In chapter 5, it's verses 12, 18, 19, and 20, the last three verses. Verse 12, 18, 19, and 20. In chapter 6, you have none. In chapter 7, verses 11 and 12, and verse 19. In chapter 8, verse 1, 5, 12, and 15. In chapter 9, they are contiguous, 7, 8, 9, and 10. There are none in chapter 10. There are four contiguous verses in 11, chapter 11, verses 7, 8, 9, and 10. The last four. And that's it. There's not another one in the book. Okay? Now, with just those couple of minutes, let's go back and just read those verses. So if you didn't catch them all, you'll be able to catch them on the fly as we go by again. Let's just read them. Chapter 2, verse 10. All of my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Verse 13, and I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. 24, 25, and 26, there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink, tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat, and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he has given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. Pardon me, feel that tingle here. Chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that there is that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. Verse 22. And I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. He who who will bring him to see what will occur after him. Verse 6, one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. Verse 13, a poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. Chapter 5, verse 12, the sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much. But the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Chapter 5, verses 18, 19, and 20, here is what I have seen to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. Chapter 7, you know, I think I may have forgotten to give you chapter 7, verse 1. A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Chapter 7, verses 11 and 12, wisdom along with an inheritance is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection as money is protection. But the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. Chapter 7, verse 19, wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. 8:1, who is like the wise man and who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. Chapter 8, verse 5, he who keeps the command, I have added the word there in italics, a royal command, experiences no trouble, for a wise heart knows the proper time and procedure. 8, verse 12, although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. And verse 15, so I commended pleasure, for there is nothing good for a man under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry. And this will stand by him in his toils throughout the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun. Chapter 9, verses 7 through 10. Go then, eat your bread in happiness, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time, and let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun. For this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you labored under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, verily do it with all your might. For there is no activity or planning or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol where you are going. Chapter 11, verses 7 through 10. The light is pleasant, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. So, remove vexation from your heart, put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. We'll close with the last two verses of chapter 12. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments, because this is the whole of man. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Amen. Go thou and do likewise.